This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Now, you're welcome back to another edition of Business Impact, the traditional one, the end of year one, the one you have, well, sort of been waiting for. This podcast, of course, comes from the UCD Business School, and we do a tradition at this time of the year. It's not quite up there with dropping the glitter ball in Times Square, but it's a sort of a time-honoured fashion where we look back at the year just gone. And the shape of this one, well, it's a little bit strange. We have one or two very large looming narratives. And then we've small bits then, I would suppose, afterwards. I know I just sound like I'm describing something you'd cook in your kitchen, but it's sort of a generally strange top-heavy list, and that's just the way the year comes. It's obviously completely subjective as well. I mean, there's no systemized look at how this happens, but we just sort of picked out what we thought was well-read, what we thought were, you know, global or national stories that had a real impact, and things that kind of carried on for a few weeks of the year, which kind of mark them out as separate sort of passing or maybe slightly faddish stories or themes that went by. But we'll get through all of that when we get a second. So we will be dissecting all the different parts of the year. All four quarters will get a mention at some stage. And my two fellow people bearing the scalpel today are Donal O'Donovan, who is the business editor at the Irish Independent. And we also have Kathleen Gallagher from the Business Post, who recently won an award for Women in Business Journalism. So congratulations to you, Kathleen, on that. You're both very welcome, and it's glad to have your input. Kathleen, I think it's your first time, but Donal, you have been a regular visitor to the recording booth with us over recent years. So listen, let's get underway. And yes, we are going to start in the inevitably and very obvious starting point, but it has to be done. Donal, we kicked off the year with Donald Trump assuming office in the White House. And then we came to Liberation Day, which he announced out in the Rose Garden, where virtually every country in the world were hit by certainly what seemed very punishing and drastic tariffs. At that point, the general consensus was this was going to be very damaging, not just for Ireland, but for the world economy. But as we come to the end of the year, it's certainly not been great. It's certainly, you know, been a pressure point on a lot of world economic performance, but maybe not quite as bad as all of us really thought. Would that be your assessment?
Notoriously, I think in the 1970s, the Zhao Enlai, the Chinese prime minister, was asked about the impact of the French Revolution and said it's probably too early to tell. And I think that's probably true in this case. We have seen in the last 6 weeks, in particular, global growth forecasts being revised up, certainly for outside of the US for next year. So the IMF and the OECD and the World Bank, our own kind of central bank here, the ECB, have been revising growth forecasts for 2026-27, which had been really kind of scaled back during that period when the tariff situation was kind of febrile and up in the air. And it may be that in the medium term, that's how that plays out. But I think it's quite a dramatic thing that has happened in terms of world trade. Two things have happened. One, as you say, Donald Trump has fairly arbitrarily kind of imposed tariffs on lots of people, most successfully, I think, on the European Union and the UK and Japan and other relatively small push-aroundable players. Not quite as dramatic as first threatened, but a 15% tariff effectively is in place on a lot of goods exports from the European Union to the US. That's a big change, and that will play out over time. The tariff situation between the US and China is up in the air. It's not settled because China has pushed back and is in a position either economically or administratively. They feel like they can push back. And I think the Canada-Mexico situation is still quite up in the air too. And actually, where we've seen in recent weeks, the US soften its stance on tariffs, it's really because costs are hitting American consumers. You know, so you've seen beef and coffee and other things like that, where there's a very direct impact on consumers. And the US is kind of the Trump administration is making a virtue of rolling back on some of its tariffs. We haven't. I mean, it is correct that the world economy did not blow up in the way that, you know, might have been predicted. The kind of the classic example in the 1930s was the US imposed very sharp tariff barriers, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, and that very much exacerbated the Great Depression because other countries retaliated. They responded in kind, sort of the eye for an eye, to some extent, left everyone blind. You haven't seen that in this scenario. So it has been more of a one-way street. Therefore, we haven't had massive disruption to actual trade. but I think it probably is early to tell. I think the markets are sanguine, more sanguine than they ought to be about the long-term impact of significant changes to the way global trade is organized. One, because there are now more tariffs than there were, and there will be more tariffs. And we're already seeing that the European Union is doing more to sort of impose its own tariffs. And then the very arbitrary way that this has happened means that in reality, the terms of global trade, and particularly the terms of trade with the US, are now unpredictable in a way that they hadn't been in really an incredibly long time. And I think there will be a price to pay for that.
Kathleen, that part about the uncertainty, the transactional nature of the Trump presidency, it's not so much the tariffs, Donald, I suppose, is arguing, but just you don't know where they're going to go next. There isn't necessarily a long-term strategy. We know President Trump wants to return manufacturing capacity to the US, but that's kind of all we know. So we don't really know what rates will go, what products will come in and out. So do you think that's more the issue for trading businesses, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think uncertainty is a big element here. I mean, Trump is kind of an unpredictable character. That is something that kind of the markets and the economy have to deal with. And I think when you look at the markets, Donald's right, like they were very sturdy during the presidency so far. Like we had some dips, but they've recovered quite strongly. And I think an FT journalist like coined a phrase called the taco trade, which is like Trump always chickens out. And it's basically now the markets don't pay so much attention to him and his kind of rhetoric because they don't believe he'll follow through. And you do kind of see that play out in some of kind of the clawback of tariffs. Like there are some estimates that just half of imports are subject to tariffs in the US, as in the new set of tariffs. So it's a combination of like, it wasn't as bad as we expected. Trump wasn't quite as strong as his word, but there is all of that uncertainty going forward. And there probably is a bit of an underestimation in terms of what happens next. And I think another big element here is obviously that we're waiting on a Supreme Court decision in the US in terms of the legality of these tariffs. There's a potential that some will have to be refunded if the Supreme Court finds in favor of the companies. And then what does the US government do? There's talk about having different sectors being challenged again, like the pharmaceutical sector, which would obviously have a big impact here in Ireland. Or like the US already has a bit of a deficit that it's contending with, and that just brings it up. And then that would be a shock to the market as well. So I think there's quite a lot there that's uncertain. But everything seems a little bit calm. So you kind of hope that calmness will stay, but it does seem like there's almost like a ticking time bomb of something has to hit at some point.
Yeah, I think you're right. And obviously the elections in November, the midterms will probably, you know, whether that weakens Trump or not, will probably play into that. Donald, if I could come to you for the second part of what's been motivating markets. We know as the year ends, they're very excitable still. They seem to be buying into the AI valuation. So there's a lot of concern. Are they stretched? Is this dot-com bust all over again? I'm old enough to have been around for the first one, so there's certainly signs there that look all too similar. But you've got Nvidia, the world's most valuable company, depending on which day you take a snapshot. But generally, most of the markets seem to be remain sanguine that these valuations can be fulfilled, that AI will fulfill its potential. As we head into 2026, yes, there are some skeptics out there, but they're very much in the minority. So where do you fall on the on that dividing line?
Yeah, I'm not sure the skeptics are in the minority, but the money is back in the hype, I guess. It's a really interesting phenomenon. I think one of the things that you're seeing with this big bet on AI and big bet on data centers, it's the Silicon Valley model now sort of ramped up almost beyond imagining. So that invest heavy, take a huge amount of risk, and hope that by doing that, you sort of establish market dominance. Has been the certainly since kind of the end of the dot-com has been the Silicon Valley model. And that was mostly on a relatively small scale. And what you saw were lots of winners and lots of losers. So if you go back to the history of, you know, payments companies invested over the last kind of 15 years in Silicon Valley, there are not a lot of Stripes to have come out of that, but Stripe comes out of it. And the people who back Stripe make sort of, you know, extraordinary gains. And that's true across lots and lots of businesses. It's a model littered with failures. And somehow people are kind of ignoring that. That sort of digital model has now entered the physical world because AI is physical and those data centers, the data centers that they're building are, or that they're looking to build, are funding on a vast scale. The energy infrastructure is on a vast scale. So the marshalling of capital is now on a much bigger scale. And it is, you know, it may well be that if that pays off, there will be winners, and they will immediately become dominant, which is very different. You know, if kind of 400 years of capitalism, you would have like lots of little companies struggling, failing, succeeding, struggling, failing, gradually sort of absorbing each other, gradually establishing kind of market dominant positions, gradually sort of becoming kind of the major players within countries and then within regions and then within kind of globally. And this model flips that on its head. The gap between winners and losers gets established quite early, and the winner takes all. It's really hard to understand how that's going to play out here, but there is vast amount of capital being marshaled, probably away from lots of good investments in other areas, I think is one thing that's happening. So what you're seeing on the stock market is only what you're seeing on the stock market. It's very much dominated by small number of names. And if it pays off, yeah, there will be winners. I think there's an underappreciation of that there are obviously going to be losers, and that when you lose this big, those losses are going to be felt everywhere. And then there is a question mark over the model. So if you're building data centers, really you're just building sheds with utilities. Once they become obsolete, they're worthless. And you know, if you're investing on a kind of a 5 or a 10 year horizon with this amount of money for something where the technology could quite quickly be kind of obsolete, there is an awful lot of risk being baked into the stock markets at the moment. And you are seeing, I mean, Oracle is the example where increasingly people are looking to short that.
Kathleen, that seems to be the company in focus. You've seen people taking out credit default swaps on this company, just a general sort of low-level concern about the debt level being stacked up by this company. Maybe it's going to be all fine and the earnings will justify it long-term. But there does seem to be, as we speak and as the year ends, and we take the sentiment into 2026, just a bit of concern around one of these hyperscaling companies. So, I mean, do you expect this to be, if the shoe drops, do you think it'll drop at all? And if it does drop, is it going to happen in the year ahead? I don't know, they're two very difficult questions to answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think Oracle is an interesting one. And I think quite a lot of people are saying it's the kind of canary in the coal mine situation, because it is one of the ones that is most indebted of those big companies. I think if you speak to investors, they're all heavily impressed with how much these hyperscalers have been able to do from just cash flow. Like, they haven't needed to borrow from the market that much. The exception there is Oracle, which has needed to borrow. And for its plans, which were expanded last week, it needs to borrow even more. And so that's why there's a lot of nervousness about there. And you mentioned the credit default swaps. So like, that is quite interesting, because look, those stocks have gone up and down, all of those hyperscalers, like depending on the announcement, depending on the move of the market, they've had some quite big swings. They're all broadly up for the year. But the debt market is slightly more interesting, because there isn't as much debt. Only a few of them have issued, Oracle the most. And the bondholders there are buying those credit default swaps at an increasing rate. And that means that they're kind of taking out some protection in case this all doesn't work out. And that just is a little more of a hint of nervousness. Like you asked, is the shoe going to drop? It's really hard to know, right? Because I think the problem with AI is we don't have the proof points yet. There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of excitement. Like, I think you speak to most people that they've experimented with ChatGPT and stuff like that. But the making money from it and seeing how all of these big changes do revolutionize business, we haven't seen that yet. So I think next year, like what investors have kind of said to me is that they need to see proof points one way or another. They need to start seeing some kind of evidence that AI is all it's being hyped up to be. And if it's not, then I think you are going to see some sharp drawdowns. And the problem is the interconnectedness of this market. Like there's a lot of conversation about how OpenAI has done a deal with Oracle and Oracle is relying on that money. But what if OpenAI doesn't work? If that doesn't work, that hits Oracle, and they're all kind of connected, and you'll see like this domino effect. So I think it's a very stressed part of the market. But that being said, almost everyone is still invested in those companies.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Everyone wants to avoid the downside, but they don't want to miss out on the upside either. So it's a tough one to get. Timing is key here, you know. Kathleen, could I just bring in a related issue, which might seem a million miles away from AI, but you're talking about market sentiment, and we have a big sale of an Irish bank going into 26. So if there is a market meltdown, unfortunately for the government, which has a big stake in permanent TSB, they would be caught up in that maelstrom. But let's say that doesn't happen for the moment. I might be judging the mood wrong here now, and you'd be closer to this than me, but it seems when the initial announcement was made, there was a reasonable sort of fair wind behind the sale. There was talk about trade buyers and private equity and maybe even a European bank coming in to buy permanent TSB or PTSB. But it seems to have gone a bit flat since then. The shares have actually come back a little bit. So do you expect, A, for this sale to complete in 26? And do you get any sense that there is much interest around this bank, either in the industry or beyond?
Who wants to buy PTSB? That is the big question. And I think there, when it was initially listed, there was a lot of speculation. There was like Bank Inter, it already has a presence. Private equity might want to come in. Like there was a lot of hype around who might come in. And I think obviously there's stuff happening in the background and it's being kept under wraps, rightly so, because it's deals. But we haven't heard very much and there's not a lot of noise around it. So much so that like some of the brokers are coming out and saying like the sell down is overdone, like there is interest out there. But it's hard to see who would want to buy PTSB. And I think that is the challenge. And I think that's also why you're getting such range of values in terms of like how to value that business. So good body values it at, I think, 2.3 billion and RBC buys it, values it at half that, at 1.1. That's a big range. So I think it'll be interesting to watch. And I do wonder whether or not the government will have to sell it for less than it wants to get that deal over a line, especially if market sentiment turns, as you were suggesting.
Yeah, and I just think, like, I mean, again, this is just a personal view, but the branch banking network, I mean, with Revolut growing and other fintechs growing, or neobanks as they're sometimes called, like, I can't see a huge appetite for that type of old traditional retail bank, but I could be wrong. I understand that PTSB has an online business, obviously, but Do you think that's a sort of a counts against the bank, that it's not seen as being in the forefront of the banking, you know, the sort of the state of the art banking model of today, that it's sort of seen as maybe a bit of a fusty kind of a structure?
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you think about a buyer, then what they have to do is they have to go in and innovate into that business and put a bunch of money into it to get it to where its competitors are. Like Revolut as well, like it has a big market share at this point now. Like it's not able to kind of challenge the pillar banks in a lot of senses, but it does have a big reputation and it's growing. And as its customer base grows up, there's the question mark about whether or not they move more of their primary banking to Revolut, and the valuation of that business is huge. And I think as well, like one of my colleagues was at this banking summit in London the other week, and he was saying that there's so much chat about AI and AI in banking, and some of these big UK brands like Lloyds are doing some really innovative things with AI that he just doesn't hear about happening from any of the Irish banks. And like innovation is going to be a big part of what they have to do to make sure that they maintain kind of their market share.
And Donal, as we sort of bid into the entry of the future world of banking, and we sort of spy into the future, what could be coming, we're also saying goodbye to the last banking crisis, which is sort of washing out of our shores. Finally, NAMA winding down as we record at the end of 2025. I understand sort of in terms of daily operations, NAMA is closing up literally as we record this. So what's the verdict? I mean, it was set up in the wake of the banking crisis, for those who don't know, and it's been managing a whole set of assets. It will return a decent dividend to the state. But was it a good idea at the time? And what's your overall verdict to, has it made a positive or negative contribution to the economy and to all of us?
It achieved some of what it was set up to achieve. It didn't achieve the very sort of primary thing that it was supposed to do, which was to sort of recapitalize the banks and get money lending again in really the the worst period of the crisis. It didn't do that. It probably couldn't have done that structurally. But what it did do was work out the bad assets once they took them on, and did find value over time in working through those assets, particularly, I suppose, the UK stuff initially. And that generated some capital, which was useful. And then gradually kind of the Irish distressed commercial property sites and things like that, they were able to find buyers, and they were, where they didn't find buyers, they were able to appoint liquidators who could work through assets. But it had quite a limited remit. I mean, the great criticism now of NAMA is not so much that it failed to get lending going again in 2010 or 2011. It's that it failed to build houses. But I mean, it wasn't really tasked with building houses on a very large scale, other than the sites that it was sitting on. So it is a bit odd to judge it on that basis. It certainly did much better than kind of the commentariat, you know, when it was set up, that the idea that NAMA was paying good money for sites that would never be anything worth anything but for grazing donkeys, I think was the David McWilliams quote. And that wasn't true. And the commercial property assets that they took on and were able to realize value on were, in many cases, you know, industrial or viable office, or in a smaller number of cases, viable residential kind of sites. As they have been worked through, then, you know, there are now offices and there are now factories and there are now apartments where those sites were. By and large, now, there are still the odd ghost estate or scrap of a ghost estate haunting kind of the border region in particular. But by and large, the assets were kind of realizable and have been worked through. There is a return for taxpayers. So on those assets, the return is rolling back into the exchequer, not at a time when the exchequer desperately needs it, it has to be said. So there's a bit of a timing mismatch. And funnily enough, yeah, if you go right back to what NAMA was supposed to do in terms of being a structure that, by removing bad loans from the bank, would help get banks back lending, that didn't happen. And actually, the banking crisis has still, and PTSB is for sale now, you know, the banking crisis never really ended. So, you know, the banking market in Ireland continues to shrink, continues to consolidate. PTSB is a challenged sale. It's probably just bad timing of that sale, but it's certainly not a slam dunk. And so there is still a shadow of the banking crisis. It's less on NAMA, I would say, and more on just that very consolidated, unattractive to outside investors, not particularly good at serving the Irish economy, banking sector, which we've been left with.
A long tail, as we would call it. Kathleen, if I could move you on to really...
A long shadow.
A tail with a shadow, or a shadow with a tail. Kathleen, if I can move you on to more general corporate developments, there hasn't been a huge amount of high-profile M&A, but there's been bits and pieces. I suppose the one that certainly caught my eye, and I think it's probably the largest in terms of the headline number involved, is the hotel group Dalata, sold off to a Scandinavian group for 1.4 billion. Some people will say, you know, the share price wasn't reflecting the underlying value, and certainly that's what the company made the point of. But also it shows what hotels are worth. You know, you can sort of break it out across their portfolio and get an idea of what a hotel in Dublin or Cork or even in the UK is currently trading at. But it was an interesting deal, wasn't it? Because there was a very high profile company, and there was a lot of talk about what they were charging and prices, and do we have too many hotels in Dublin and other places as well? But it went reasonably smoothly. And I think, as far as I can see, most people were reasonably happy with the premium that the buyer paid.
Like, if we're talking about deals that went smoothly rather than kind of a challenge deal, I think Dalata is an example of one that went smoothly. I mean, the kind of Scandinavian buyer initially went in and kind of just had a holding and didn't really tell us what it was about. And then they kind of finished off the deal, and then it was all announced, and the share price like reacted favorably on that. But as you were saying, there is quite a lot of discussion about how it was valued by the market. And in general, if you look at European and UK listed companies, there's this feeling that they've been undervalued by the market for a long time. And so that they will be, the smaller companies will come and they will be eaten up by other bigger firms that see value in them. And that is a trend that's kind of still working its way through, although the UK and the European markets are starting to come back a bit more. So that might be less of a case. But M&A is a tricky one. I mean, there hasn't been a huge amount of M&A in Ireland or elsewhere, really. And there isn't a massive expectation that will kind of tick back up. Like, kind of these bolt-on acquisitions, like the Scandinavian group buying Dalata, they're probably more likely because that integration is a bit easier. Big mergers, it's hard to make them work. Like if you look at Smurfit and WestRock, that deal, like there's still an expectation that it will come through, that all of those, I guess people call them synergies, will happen. But at that moment, it hasn't had the best year. Its share price is down and it hasn't really made those made that deal work for shareholders. So it's a hard one. M&A is a hard one. And I'm not sure we'll see much more of it.
Yeah, just to honorable mentions, DCC selling its tech business. And of course, as the year closed, we have Netflix trying to buy Warner Brothers, although Paramount might yet have something to say about that. Let's move into a bigger theme, Donal, which is, I suppose, personalities that dominate the year. It's not all about dry, arid companies, but people, you know, and how influential they can be. One of the things that came across was this whole tech bros idea, which obviously emanated from Elon Musk, who headed up Doge earlier this year. And of course, he saw a lot of the tech bros, same said group of people at the Trump inauguration and so on. So, you know, we saw this piece in the Irish Times from the Collison brothers talking about, you know, we need a better performance by the state on infrastructure, which was interesting. Obviously, I mentioned Elon Musk, you have Dermot Desmond chipping in and whether we need a metro. I mean, do you welcome very wealthy sort of some of them in tech, some of them not, contributing to, you know, civic debates? Or does that worry you? Or do you think that's just the way of the world and everyone is happy to contribute to the conversation? Or because it just seemed to be a theme during the year that, you know, business people, entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them, were chipping in on various issues in the public sphere, I suppose. So what was your take on all of that?
I suppose what's interesting is that, yeah, business people seem to have the self-confidence to do this again. Kathleen probably doesn't remember. You and I are old enough to remember when prominent business people would have been kind of regular features on the Saturday morning shows or the Sunday morning shows on RTE, spouting all sorts of opinions about all sorts of things. And that did kind of go by the wayside after the crash. And I think there was a sort of a pulling in of horns to some extent, a loss of confidence maybe to another extent. And we're probably just kind of a long way from that now. And maybe there's a sense that business people are getting a bit of their mojo back and their confidence to sort of opine. It's a sign of how long it has been since we've had a big kind of business crisis that business people are again kind of confident enough to sort of, I suppose, to do what, you know, you think of, I guess, as thought leadership in a wider context than their own business. But I think it is important to hear that from lots of people.
Yeah, it's interesting you're tying it into the confidence newly rediscovered. Yeah, that, I hadn't actually thought about it. And you certainly, they did disappear, vanish, I think, after the financial crisis. So yeah, it is interesting to see them coming back on the stage. We lost a few people during the year, just to briefly mention, because we're up against time constraints. Eddie Jordan, of course, from the whole Formula One world, a very lively, colourful character. Sad to see him go. And an equally live and voluble character, John Mullins, who was the boss at one stage of Bord Gáis and had political interests and a lot of stuff in the energy sector, and a real sort of ambassador for the Cork business community. So we lost him as well. So sad for them and their family, just to mention that. Leaving the stage, but not in any mortal sense, Kathleen, was Pascal Donoghue, the former finance minister, seemed to come out of nowhere, joining the World Bank at quite a senior level. Various, you know, tussles over his legacy as a finance minister. He's actually a former guest of this podcast, so we should just briefly mention he was on here about 2 years ago or so. It was great to have him at the time. But were you surprised to see him leaving the government and sort of the way everyone was kind of caught cold by it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting wasn't it? Because I feel like there's been conversations about Pascal leaving for quite a while. There's kind of been this expectation that he was destined to some extent for bigger and better things, but it did still feel like it caught everyone off guard a little bit, and just was a bit of a shock announcement. Like, and I mean, impressive that he managed to keep it quiet for so long, because I'm sure the kind of move was a long time in the making. But you know, Pascal, he was a very articulate minister. Like, he was very well spoken, and kind of able to get his points across very clearly. And I think that's going to be greatly missed. And kind of from a more immediate perspective, you know, there is kind of this unsettledness within like the finance industry as well about him leaving, because there were things that he had in train that he kind of said changes were going to happen, for instance, around taxes on investment and that kind of thing, that they then feel when a new minister comes in, doesn't really matter who the new minister is, they have to get on top of all of these very intricate issues and then continue the change. And they kind of feel like when those portfolios move, it's really difficult. So I think, you know, Pascal, he left a brilliant legacy. I mean, there can be conversation in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly kind of thing. But broadly speaking, he has kind of been a good politician from the Irish perspective. But what happens next is a tricky one, I think.
Donal, I'm going to leave the last word for you. We didn't have a lot of good news. We didn't have a lot of closures. There was some collateral damage in the retail sector for certain. And we have an ongoing drip, drip, drip of pub closures, which you can see all across the country from time to time as well. But we didn't have huge losses of jobs where we did have in the previous year in the tech sector. I see Paddy Power, though, closing down some branches, on-street branches, as that, I suppose, changing business model. So could I ask you just to reflect on one, the lack of closures, which is good, but, you know, some trends there under the surface going on to do with the high street?
People know that the gambling business has largely moved online, right? That's largely a digital business now. So it's no surprise to see shops on the main street closing down. And people know that the pub trade is not what it was, because people's drinking habits have changed very dramatically. Partly as a result of just social change, partly as a result of things like, you know, I'm from rural parts of the country and pushing 50, drink driving laws have changed the rural landscape pretty significantly and changed the nature of the rural pub. And so have other things. And people have lots of kind of alternatives to the pub now. And certainly pubs that where they haven't changed and they don't have a big passing trade are really challenged. There's a bit of stress, obviously, that we've heard about in the hospitality sector. And controversially, they got their big, big budget gain in October, but it doesn't kick in till July. But by and large, I think, you know, consumer spending is up. Employment, which is really what tells when you get distress in the economy, it's because the job numbers are down. The job numbers aren't really down. They're kind of flat. I mean, I don't think you could take future job growth for granted, but it's still a very buoyant jobs market. Most people have jobs. More people are working than have ever worked in the country in the past. And if you want a job, you'll be able to get a job in Ireland at the moment. And I wouldn't take that for granted. But that is kind of underpinning, you know, the retail trade. It's underpinning the hospitality trade, is underpinning construction, it's underpinning lots and lots and lots of other things. And that is kind of the core of kind of the sort of prosperity that you can actually go out and feel, as opposed to necessarily, you know, big amounts of money washing in and out of the exchequer because of kind of faraway tax changes. So that's all kind of fine at the moment. And as long as it is, as long as people are working, then there is sort of the sort of financial wherewithal to support businesses, even if the margins are stretched, so costs are up, and I think small businesses are feeling kind of strain, particularly on the labor side at the moment. But as long as the customers are buying, then you know the margin might be tight, but at least the margin is there. The problem would be if we have any sort of, and it does feel a little bit vulnerable that if anything was to kick the legs out of the jobs market, the consequences, albeit small businesses don't have a huge amount of debt, I think their margins aren't brilliant, so that you would see kind of knock-on consequences quite fast.
Well, great. It's been a whistle-stop tour. I think you started, Donal, with the French Revolution and you're ending in a pub in rural Limerick. So it's been some conversation with you, both of you, going through all these items. We are against time, 38 minutes clocking in. A strange year. A lot of it, as you can see from listening to the conversation, is about next year because, you know, it's obviously the way, but sometimes you can see some seeds have been planted in 25 and whether they pay off or don't, you talk about AI and tariffs and all the rest in 26, definitely worth both of you returning same time next to see how things have settled down. But for the moment, Kathleen Gallagher of the Business Post, thank you very much. And Donal O'Donovan of The Independent, we really appreciate both of you inputting and enjoy your time off.
Brilliant, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.